Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast, episode 114. This is the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. With me is Dan Webb. Hi, Dan.
Good evening, everyone, and greetings from school this time, sadly.
You're not happy to be back in school, Dan?
It's great to return to a place of higher learning, but summer was nicer.
That's true. I remember those days. All right. Also with us is Rob Mark. Hi, Rob.
Hi. Welcome, everybody.
Where are you? You're in Wichita?
Oh, I'm in beautiful Wichita, Kansas. I'm here for the NASAO conference, which is the National Association of State Aviation Officials. But I also, the fun part is I got to fly the Cessna Skycatcher yesterday.
Ah, wow.
From Wichita Mid-Continent. It was, what a fun time that was. It was so cool.
Did it live up to your expectations?
Actually, you know, it really did. And I know that I'm probably a little biased because I've been flying Cessnas my whole life, but I really did like the airplane. And I had such a good time. It's so simple to fly and it's so easy to fly. And the thing I like about it is it has lots of glasses, great visibility. And it was just a good time.
Sounds great. Sounds like they have a winner.
Yeah, I think they do.
Cool. Also here is David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian and resident military aviation expert. Hi, David.
Oh, wow. The titles keep getting longer and longer. Hi, listeners.
Our guest this episode is Benay Wilson. She's online managing editor of business aviation for the Aviation Week group. Benay, welcome back to the podcast.
I am so glad to be back. Thank you for having me. And I have to ask one question on behalf of myself and Richard Abalafia.
Oh, sure.
When do we get our green jackets?
Well, I think this is, if I count correctly, this might be number 6 for you, which kind of puts you ahead of the pack. So we may have to...
I think Richard should have a jacket too, just because I like him, because he likes Belgian beer like me.
Well, we don't have jackets, but because we're kind of cheap. We do have t-shirts, so I think we can... We can accommodate that, probably.
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
And actually, we were going to get sun visors, too. We were going to get Airplane Geek sun visors that you can put over your head.
And who's going to watch? Who's going to wear them?
Well, geeky people.
All right. Coming up, we have David's This Week in Aviation. We also have the Australia Desk Report from Steve and Grant. A couple of terrific listener voicemails, and we'll look forward to those. But first... let's start with the week's aviation news. First up, this is from the Los Angeles Times. Hidden airline fees targeted by new travel coalition. Well, it turns out that there's a new group that's been formed by three travel organizations called Mad as Hell About Hidden Fees.com. I think what's happened here is the American Society of Travel Agents has gotten together with the Consumer Travel Alliance and the Business Travel Coalition, and the three of them have put together this website. They're trying to encourage people to fill out an online petition, and this would be something that urges the DOT, the Department of Transportation, to require that airlines disclose all fees through all ticketing channels, not just on their own websites. And they've even gone so far as to set up September 23rd as Mad as Hell Day. Now, we've talked about fees in the past. I think that it's, you know, probably a consumer, you know, friendly position to say that, you know, all the fees applicable to your flight should be made known to you in advance so that you know what your total cost is going to be. Do you guys think this is something that's really necessary?
I guess I wonder what the fees are that they think are still hidden. I didn't see that part in there. I mean, what are the fees?
Well, they were talking about things like the carry-on bag fees. The carry-on bag, the baggage fees, the seat reservations when you pick the special seats, and phone reservations, those sort of things. And I just feel like people are annoyed by them, but they know that they're out there. So, I mean...
Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking.
I don't see this. And plus, when I got the press release, I looked at it and I'm thinking, oh... they want to get rid of the fees. And it's like, well, no.
No, they're not.
Started reading into it. They don't want to get rid of the fees. They just want the fees to be more transparent. And I don't, I'm just not seeing it.
Well, they say that they conducted an online survey, an informal online survey, whatever that means. So I guess that means not scientific, where they asked almost 1,400 air travelers to answer a couple of questions. And they found that 2/3 of them said that they were surprised at the airport by unexpected fees. I would not have guessed that there would have been that many air travelers arriving at the airport unaware that they were going to have to pay some fees.
Well, there are probably also a lot of people that probably didn't realize that Barack Obama was president either, but that doesn't necessarily mean that
that's true.
You know, that we need another regulation. But
hey, he won?
Yeah, well, I heard he did. I think there's been a recount. Well, we won't go off on that tangent.
You know, it's kind of interesting if you look at the website they've set up, which is madashellabouthiddenfees.com. They have a section for where travelers can share their stories, and they have kind of a number of comments submitted by air travelers. One writes, Jim writes, "I'm mad as hell about hidden airline fees. Once again, I got to Reagan Airport and was slammed with a host of fees on top of the cost I had been told up front. This made me mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore." And there's a lot of other comments that are sort of along that vein. So maybe there really are a lot of consumers out there that just aren't aware of what the situation is in with the airlines these days.
Yeah, and part of it is I think now it's a lot more stable than it was before, but but the fees are still changing, and airlines are still adding new ancillary revenue sources. And the sense that I got, and Binet probably knows this better than I do, and this actually might be a good topic to talk to you about with Henry Hardeveld about if we can get him back. But the sense that I get is with a lot of these fees, it's kind of you have to pay them at the airport or on the website just because it seems in some cases the addition of the fees kind of outpaced the technology that the airlines had. And the sense that is just it takes more retooling to be able to pay for these in different ways. The name I know.
Wait a minute. Are you saying
that
they can charge the fees, but the technology does not have a way to tell the consumer that they're paying that what it is they're charging these fees for?
I think it's been an issue talked about, and this is something where I don't know a whole lot about, and this is where I'm relying on the world of airplane dorkdom. But the sense that I've got is that while airlines can do this on their own website, that it's a bit more difficult to do it via a website like Travelocity or Orbitz. That's what I'm talking about.
All right. Well, if you're so inclined, you can visit their website. And if you have your own horror stories about hidden fees, you can contribute them. Or if you're so inclined, you can sign their online petition. Okay, moving on to our next story. This is from Business Week. Virgin America lifts second quarter revenue, but losses persist. Virgin America has announced that new flights helped bring its second quarter revenue up by 35%, but they've made only a little progress in narrowing their quarterly loss. So how do you take this, Dan? How do you read this?
I was a little disappointed. I'm not going to lie.
You were expecting better results?
Virgin has been saying for a while that they were forecasting a full year operating profit. And for them, like many other airlines, it's the second and third quarter where they're going to see the best performance. So now with losses in the first and second quarter, the third quarter has to impress. Now, right now, Virgin is saying that they are still planning for a full year operating profit. And some of the numbers look good. I mean, unit revenues up over 20%. The load factor was down a little bit, which I was wondering about. Costs, excluding fuel, still down a little bit. So I guess I get the sense it's good, but not great. I mean, we'll see what other airlines report that are private. But I mean, right now, it's just them and American that lost money in the second quarter. So I was hoping for a profit. Granted, it was a very small operating loss, $430,000. And they said, you know, excluding hedges, adjusting for their fuel derivative contracts, they would have made a $10 million profit. But I was expecting for more, basically. And we'll see how it goes. But for liquidity, their cash position and liquidity position went down a little bit, which, you know, kind of a concern as well. Mm-hmm. So I we'll see what happens. They're adding a couple new cities. I mean, they're a great carrier. I love the product. And we'll see what the new cities bring. I mean, they're going into Dallas, which is very interesting because it's a very crowded market with a lot of competition, with especially from American. And we'll also have to see how it goes adding Cabo and Cancun, with Cabo, I believe, coming in December and Cancun coming in January. Markets that I mean, you wouldn't traditionally associate with them, trying to go with business markets. But they say they'll reduce the seasonality of their network, the seasonality of their performance, rather. So we'll see. And plus, Orlando comes in October. So, I mean, I really love this airline, but I just want them to make money. And I mean, we'll see how it goes.
You know, Dan, it occurs to me, I haven't heard any flack recently about the percentage of U.S. ownership of Virgin America. Has that issue died away, or I just haven't seen anything?
No, that actually, nothing's really changed there in the past. In the past few months, there were some changes to their ownership structure, which was a couple changes to their ownership structure earlier this year, with just changing some investors. And it seems to be a moot point right now. I mean, Alaska has complained in the past, but
right, yep.
I mean, if this was an issue, I think the DOT would have done something by now.
Okay.
So were you forced to sell your Virgin America stock, Dan?
I actually would have helped if I had owned any stock, because the issue is how much does the Virgin Group, owned by Richard Branson, obviously, own?
I think 25%, right?
Yeah, 25%, which is the limit in the U.S.
Right.
Well, my question is, you know, this has been, I don't want to say dragging along, but this has been going along for a while. And, you know, I've interviewed David Cush, and, you know, he's talked about wanting to get into the New York market, into the Chicago. Now, I know it's not his fault, you know, but these losses continue. They're doing some what I call interesting markets, the Mexico markets. I mean, how long can they continue to go like this? And I mean, I've never flown them, but everyone that I know that's flown them just loves them. But I mean, how long can you sustain this operation?
It depends how much, you know, if they can keep getting money. I mean, they've successfully been able to, you know, take on more debt. I mean, they have raised money through debt before. So, until they can keep getting money or become self-sustaining with their own cash flow, we'll see. Like, I've flown Virgin for the first time this summer. And, you know, full disclosure, it was a free flight for a press event. But I love the product. If you're a business traveler, you can say, well, Virgin has a great product. You know, I love the seatback TVs. I love the power. I love the internet, all that. But they don't fly everywhere.
Exactly.
So, I mean, if you live in San Francisco, okay, maybe on some of the business routes, Virgin's there, a great product, but United's going to fly to a lot more places. Sure, the product's not as great. I'm going to have elite status. There's a good chance of a first-class upgrade, which kind of compensates a little bit for the product efficiency I get. But then, you know, you're in a loyalty program that can take you virtually anywhere in the world through Star Alliance. So, and I think Virgin just needs to keep building up the network. And, I mean, they are working to expand their reach. I mean, they'll be the interline with El Al, Qatar, Virgin Blue, Virgin Atlantic coming up. And they are the three Virgin airlines have last month unveiled in their Frequent Flyer partnership, which would allow to earn and redeem miles on any Virgin-branded carrier.
Okay, moving on to telegraph.co.uk. Tells us that BA's Willie Walsh and Iberia's Antonio Vasquez have been talking about the future of the holding company for both of them now, which is International Airlines Group, or IAG. And they've been looking at possible acquisition targets, that being other airlines. And they have a list of 12 of them. They're not saying who the 12 are. But there are some guesses, I guess, according to this article, that might include Qantas, South African Airways, Finnair, and one low-cost operator, perhaps Air Asia. But they're not saying who or what or when.
Well, and the other issue here is maybe some of our international listeners could help on this one. What exactly the rules are? So, like in this case, a foreign entity can't take more of 20% of a stake in a U.S. airline. So are there any regulatory hurdles with expanding internationally. I'm assuming there are some, and I believe maybe Stephen Grant can help with this next week, because again, I don't know. Yeah, I think that's been one hurdle with the potential BA Qantas rumors in the past.
Well, I mean, it doesn't seem like, I think inter-Europe, I don't, like, if they were going after Finnair, I don't think that's going to be a problem. But, I question, you know, one of them is South African Airways. You know, I question how that would work. And it would be really fun to kind of speculate on some of the other airlines that might be the 12. And I got a chuckle because I'm looking at this article, and right next to it is a picture of Ryanair's Michael O'Leary. Yeah. And wouldn't that be fun if it was on the list? Highly unlikely, but it still is fun.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't. Qantas, that sounds like a tough one to me. I sort of have difficulty seeing that being feasible for a couple of different reasons. And Finnair, I don't know. It's been a while since I've met with the Finnair folks, but last time I did, they sort of struck me as a fairly, you know, proud and nationalistic group. And unless there's some significant financial motivation for them hooking up with IAG, I can't see that happening either. But I don't know. Maybe this is just. Well, I think one of the interesting things was that they started with a blank sheet of paper, and it says that the original list was some 40 airlines long. So I guess this is the short list.
Well, it just makes me wonder. I mean, Lufthansa has had a nice little buying spree. Is there anything left in Europe for them to buy?
Yeah, at a decent price.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm thinking that they could pick up Japan Airlines real cheap these days. Yeah.
But the other issue is what Max talked about with the nationalism thing is, I mean, that's what Lufthansa and Air France KLM have been doing is, I mean, keeping everybody in under one holding carrier, but yeah. Keeping the brands.
USA Today has a piece, Travel industry uses Facebook and Twitter to reach customers. This is how the industry, including hotels, the airlines, and so forth, are increasingly making use of, you know, social networking kinds of tools for business purposes. Examples being Facebook, Twitter, YouTube. You can buy, I think we mentioned this a few episodes ago, Delta allows you to buy tickets off of Delta's Facebook page. Southwest has three staffers who are actually dedicated to monitoring and responding to queries that come in through social media. Many hotels have presence online through Facebook or other means. All the time you see, you know, specials on Twitter that people can take advantage of. So, I mean, this has been quite a sea change, Binay. Do you think there's a lot of power behind this change?
I actually do. I think that airlines and hotel chains were kind of poo-pooing this until they saw an ability to make some money off of this and also kind of put a human face to their company. I mean, I can't say enough about what Delta is doing with their Twitter account, Delta Assist.
Yes.
I wrote about that when they first started. They've got people who just answer passenger questions, and my only criticism was that they were only open during the week, basically from 9 in the morning to 8 at night, and they just recently went 24/7 over the weekend. So, I mean, it shows that they're out there and they're listening to their customers. Another one that I really like that's active on Twitter is the Grand Hyatt Hotel at DFW. And they, you know, they're always on engaging with people, and I just think that it gives travelers a good feeling to know that somebody's out there actually listening to them and responding quickly.
Yeah, sure. I mean, imagine, say, 10 years ago, and if you tried to get the attention or you wanted to get the attention of an airline, just attempting to do that would have been just an extreme struggle, I think. And these days, it's for at least some of the airlines, it's much different.
Some, but not all.
Some, but not all.
But I think at this point, basically all the major carriers in the U.S., I think have a, at minimum, a half-decent Twitter presence now.
Well, they have a Twitter presence. I don't want to pick on anyone, but I'll just say U.S. Airways, for example. I mean, they do have a Twitter account. I think they use it a lot to kind of push out some of their employee information and stuff, but I don't see them as active interacting with travelers as I do, say, Delta or Southwest or Virgin America.
One of the things that sort of caused me some concern when looking through this article was about the use of bloggers. And I think this was sort of epitomized in the comments of the vice president of marketing for Carlson Hotels, who's talking about, you know, engaging bloggers to write about the hotel and to, you know, spread a message via that media. But he says that bloggers and their families in this case were assigned to drive to College Station in vehicles with country and decals, stop in seven states, blog and post messages on Facebook and Twitter along the way. Country Inn received local news coverage, and the bloggers helped spread word of the new hotel to their followers. He said that we learned the power of what we can do. Does this cross a line, though, when, in this case, a hotel or in other cases, you know, airlines get really cozy with content creators, new media content creators, and kind of use them as an extension of their marketing function?
I think this can definitely be a problem because, I mean, it's not uncommon for airlines or hotels. I mean, if they have a big event, to, you know, invite press and comp them, you know, travel or hotel or whatever. But I mean, if it's someone who's a working member of the press, usually they know, you know, they're not going to let that affect anything. But I guess the fear that I have, and I say this as a blogger, and this is why the FTC has these rules now, is that if a company gives out free crap, if you're a blogger, you're like, ooh, look, someone paid attention to me, I'm going to only write positive things about you now.
Mm.
This is why the FTC, I mean, had those rules. I forget when those came out, that, you know, if you're a blogger and, you know, someone gives you a product or something to review, you're supposed to say, I got this for free.
And I think it also depends on the blogger, too. So
yes,
let's just
absolutely.
I'm going to throw it out there. Let's just say my good friend Cranky Flyer. I'm much
yeah. Oh,
more
yeah. His ethics page is awesome because he lists every free thing he's offered.
Yes. And plus, I know Brett, and I know his writing style, and I know that he's not going to pull any punches, even if somebody is giving him something for free. But you don't get that with other bloggers. So it might be like Dan said, it might be like somebody like, oh, let's say Rob Mark, who gets like a free plane ride and just goes crazy, waxing poetic. But I'm only saying Rob Mark, if Rob Mark wasn't as famous as he is, if he was just generic Rob Mark.
See, and I really thought you were going to say because I was, you know, if I wasn't as handsome as I am, but.
Well, that too. But,
yeah,
you know,
okay.
You have to also consider the source. And I think that the audience out there is savvy enough to know, like, something with this Carlson thing. I mean, that was a cute little stunt, but it's like, are you going to be able to continue to do that? People are going to say, oh, they've done this before, been there, done that, and who are these people? You know, what are they trying to do? I think, you know, you can do certain things a number of times, but after a while, I think the traveling public gets a little savvy and is looking for the next little trick.
Mm. You know, another thing that occurred to me as I was reading this was that, you know, sometimes it's interesting to watch how companies get used to something new. And a lot of times they have a lot of false starts. I mean, I was sort of reminded by when the web first got started and when companies, for-profit companies, started to realize that maybe they should consider having a web page. And a lot of web pages went up and a lot of them were not very effective and really didn't offer any value to either the consumer or the company. So, I mean, I find myself wondering, you know, what's happening in this case? I mean, are people jumping into this, you know, into this arena, Facebook and Twitter and so forth, and doing dumb things because they don't get it? Or do you think that they do get it, or that only companies that do get it are jumping in? In other words, are they being effective when they use these kinds of methods to increase their business or to provide more value to customers?
I think it actually depends on the company. I think you're going to naturally see some trial and error. I mean, Rob and I have had these discussions about social media, the good, the bad, and the ugly, about, you know, how people are just kind of throwing themselves out there because they feel like they need to do something, but there's no adult supervision of – you know, how are we going to do this? How is it going to bring a return? That sort of thing. I mean, Rob and I have talked about this, and I'm going to give a shout out to Christy Van Alken, who's the Senior VP of Marketing at Akron Canton Airport. And I mean, she has incorporated social media into her communications and PR plan, and she's got it down to a science with, you know, the numbers to quantify what they're doing. And a lot of companies do that, but a lot of companies don't. They're just throwing out stuff to see what sticks to the wall. Mm. Or they're hiring quote-unquote social media experts that come in and give them all kinds of crazy advice and then, you know, run out. Oh, that didn't work. Let's try this. So, yeah.
Well, you know, and something I would add to that too is that I see companies trying things with social media. And sometimes – I can't tell for sure if they really believe the public is that stupid, or maybe the public is that stupid that they don't question anything. But then we go back and look at that. Who is the sports blogger that posted that thing with the Washington Post last week and got suspended for a month?
Yes.
He just made up a fact and said, let's see what happens, and everybody ran with it. Mm-hmm. But I do believe, too, that the same concept is true. If Binet writes something about a company that is very positive, I never questioned, gee, I wonder if they paid her for that. Because she's been around this long enough, and that reputation, I think, means an awful lot. But, you know, when you find these little blogs that – or somebody tweeting that says, and I get these things every so often about the iPhone or something else, and you go, this is junk. I mean, I don't know if they paid somebody, right. But it sounds like it's been paid for because it's so poorly written.
Hmm. All right, switching now to a military story. This is from Boeing. First biofuel-powered military helicopter takes flight. So the Royal Netherlands Air Force, the RNLAF, has flown an Apache. You're using a blend of biologically derived sustainable jet fuel. And David, I guess this was kind of seen as a success, at least in terms of how well did the helicopter fly.
How well it was a success can be determined by the fact that not only did they do a test flight, but the Apache demonstration team went off and used the fuel to perform aerobatic demonstrations at various airports using the same biofuel. So this wasn't... Like we've had in a previous, we've talked about the F-18 that they launched on for Earth Day, where it went up, did a couple of circuits, and landed using this biofuel JP-8. In this case, the Apache team went off and did a bunch of air shows with it. So if you're willing to perform aerobatic maneuvers, and it's not like our Apache demos here in the States, they actually roll the aircraft, do pyrotechnics and such. This is a real success. They were really using it as a wide open biofuel with no fear. So this is a major step for what's coming.
Well, whether it's military use, like in this case, or some of the commercial demonstration flights, I guess you would call them, that we've seen in the past, I haven't heard a sort of a single negative thing about the usability of this biofuel. I mean, it seems like this is something that, given that it's something that's in our future, as long as there are no cost or major distribution kinds of hiccups.
I think the U.S. government and Boeing and everyone else involved, they're really serious about this. And it's sort of a quiet change, which may not be a bad thing if you just sort of change it over time and not make a major production of it. Someone will look back and go, oh, my God, we've gone green.
Yeah.
So I don't think there's a major anything wrong with not making a major production out of it.
And Max, I mean, I was happy to read this story. I've actually really gotten into reading all of the stories on the Boeing blog. I did a blog post and a story about Boeing and their social media efforts. And one of the things that they're doing is they're stepping it up with stories like these. They're basically using the people and the customers of Boeing to kind of tell Boeing's story. And I am the daughter and granddaughter of Air Force officers, but the military side has never been my big thing until I started reading these stories on the blog. So I have to give kudos to Boeing for, you know, for highlighting these stories and making them interesting.
Making them interesting,
to people,
right.
Even if you don't like, if you're not into the military side of aviation.
Yeah, that's great. They're doing a good job with an effective job of communicating.
So, Binet, you're coming around, huh?
I am. I am.
We'll chip at it a little bit by a little bit, and eventually you'll be converted.
And then I also wanted to just put in a little plug, since we're still on the military side. Aviation Week on Monday is launching a new section to the defense section channel of our website.
Right.
It's Check 6. It's going to be tracking developments on tactical aircraft. And it's actually up now, but it officially launches tomorrow. We've got some of our best military and defense editors writing for this, including Amy Butler, Dave Fulgham, Bill Sweetman, Robert Wall, Graham Warwick, the Oracle, and Michael Bruno. So I encourage you all to just go on over to aviationweek.com/check6 and check it out. We've got pictures, videos, blog posts, stories.
Cool. Is that 6 the number or SIS?
Yeah, the number 6.
Okay,
the
check 6. Very good. Okay, well, I understand that Rob received an interesting recording. Is that right, Rob, about something called Lutheran Air?
Sorry, there we go. Yeah, it's for those folks that want to travel on the airlines in the upper Midwest up to Wisconsin and into Minnesota and North Dakota. And so I got that promotional audio, and I just I put it on the web there. So I hope you guys will play some of it.
Okay, now this contains sort of some regional humor, so many of our international listeners may not quite get this, but I think you'll get the drift.
We are pleased to announce Lutheran Airlines is now operating in Minnesota and also serving Wisconsin, northern Michigan, and North and South Dakotas. If you're traveling soon, consider Lutheran Air, the no-frills airline. You're all in the same boat on Lutheran Air. Here, flying is an uplifting experience. There is no first class on Lutheran Air. Meals are potluck. Rows 1 through 6 bring rolls. 7 through 15 bring a salad. 16 through 21 a hot dish. And 22 through 30 a dessert. Basses and tenors, please sit in the rear of the aircraft. Everyone is responsible for his or her own baggage. All fares are by free will offering, and the plane will not land till the budget is met. Pay attention to your flight attendant, who will acquaint you with the safety system aboard the Lutheran airline. Okay, now, listen up. I'm only going to say this once. In the event of a sudden loss of cabin pressure, I am frankly going to be real surprised, and so will Captain Olson, because we fly around 2,000 feet or so, so loss of cabin pressure would probably mean the second coming or something of that nature, and I wouldn't bother with those little masks and the rubber hoses. You're going to have much bigger problems to worry about than that. Just stuff those back in their little holes. Probably the masks fell out because...
Now, Rob, do we have any idea where this came from?
No, absolutely none. Somebody sent it to me completely unsolicited, and I did go back and say, where did you get that from? I have no idea. Someone sent it to me. It's been traveling everywhere, but I just thought it was so funny that we had to play it. If the producer's out there someplace, please let us know who you are. We want to credit you, even if you do live in Minnesota.
And if anyone is offended, rob@jetwine.com, everybody.
That's right. Except, you know what? For once, being a nice Swedish boy, I can get away with this because these are actually my people.
So I guess that means I'm out, right, Rob?
I think you're out, yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Are you kind of a, you know, blonde hair, blue eye type or?
Yeah.
No.
No? Okay. No, I'd say you're out then. Yeah.
I feel we're starting to go down a really, really, really slippery slope, but I don't know these things.
Where did you learn these big words, Dan? Slippery slope. Have you heard red herring? Have you heard that one yet?
Yes, yes.
Okay, good. This is good. Binet, can you lay any more of those on him? I mean, to see if he knows what they mean?
I don't know. His head might explode.
Yeah, that would be kind of a bad thing, yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
All right. Well, we're speaking with Binet Wilson. Again, she's the online managing editor for Business Aviation with Aviation Week. Binet, tell us, we have an event coming up, don't we, NBAA?
Yes, we do. It's going to be in Atlanta this year. And we just did a report in the Weekly of Business Aviation about the prospects for the show this year. And it's kind of a good news and not horrible news. The good news is that all of the manufacturers are going to have space on the exhibit hall this year. Last year, we had several manufacturers, including Cessna and Hawker Beechcraft, that only had displays out at the static display. NBAA last year was, you know, I think people were still kind of in the down mode. There were wide areas of space on the showroom floor. I mean, one space was large enough. I mean, Rob and I could have played a really good game of putt-putt golf in this space. Huh. But this year they're saying that the numbers look on target. I mean, the numbers overall I think are still down, but it's looking a lot better than it did last year and the year before. So.
Now, just in case someone doesn't know, the NBAA is, of course, the National Business Aviation Association. Rob, are you going to be there this year?
I certainly am. Ah. Binet, you're going, I'm sure, right? So we'll be at this. There's some couple of tweet-ups and a few other things. And we're going to do is really go to some bar somewhere, I think, and just, you know, have some cocktails, but... No, so it should be fun. It's always a good time. It's always good to see all the people from the industry, and I know this year I think it's almost going to be tougher this year economically than it was last year. I think last year everyone knew the economy was in the tank, mm-hmm. and this year it seems as if we have gotten to a point where it's not much better than last year. maybe a little better, but not much, and that's about all we could say.
So business aviation hasn't sort of turned the way that perhaps commercial aviation has, huh?
Well, I don't think it has yet.
And what's interesting – no, I don't think so either. And what's interesting is depending on who you talk to, the recovery is anywhere from the middle of 2011 out to 2015, depending on whose forecast you're looking at or who you're talking to.
2015.
So, I mean, I think people are just taking a wait-and-see attitude. We do have a couple of bright spots. Gulfstream, you know, with the G650, the testing continues with that. Embraer coming out with the Legacy 650. So, you know, we are seeing a few bright spots. And the hemorrhaging that happened all last year and part of this year seems to have slowed in some categories and even stopped in other categories. So,
is there something that the industry could do, do you think, that would sort of accelerate the recovery? Or is it just they just have to, you know, kind of ride on the economy in general?
I think that they have to ride on the economy in general. And, you know, they've got all these campaigns out there because, you know, a lot of companies got scared with all of this scrutiny by the Obama administration about, you know, watching costs, especially if you took TARP money. And I think it scared a lot of companies. I remember Gulfstream last year, they took Starbucks took an order of a new Gulfstream that they had ordered 3 years ago. And it happened, unfortunately, to coincide when they cut their dividend and they cut some benefits for employees. So the negative publicity kind of pressured them into not taking the order. And the same thing happened with J.P. Morgan. They were replacing some aging business jets, but, you know, they took money from TARP and they got a lot of pushback. So I think, you know, part of it is the economy and part of it is telling people don't be scared. You know, you need these as a business tool. You still have to conduct your business and these jets help you do that. So I think it's just a balance of those. Do you agree, Rob?
Yeah, I really do. And I guess the one thing that we're probably seeing, and it's probably only a factor of the way life works out, is that most of the large aircraft manufacturers have stopped seeing all the cancellations that they were involved in. And I mean, that's been good news. And of course, you have certainly Cessna hasn't come back yet. And I know I'm sorry, who's the other folks I'm thinking of? Not the Bombardier, but the Dassault people. I was thinking of Dassault. I mean, they have not seen the orders return yet, but at least they've stopped losing them, which, again, that's why I basically said it may not be great, but it's better. At least it's not as bad as it was. And but then we look at the economic growth in the United States, and it depends on how you look at it. We've heard people from the administration say, look, there's positive economic growth. And there is. However, there's not enough to really sustain the economy in the way we become used to it. I mean, I think that when you've had under 2% growth, you can't even sustain the jobs that we had. And so it kind of depends on how you define everything, but we have no choice. I mean, we have to live with what we can do and just keep it on, I guess. Maybe that's the best way to put it.
Uh-huh. Okay, Binet, Rob, I got a question for you. You both have talked about the U.S. economy. All of these other foreign nations are buying jet airliners. Why aren't they buying biz jets?
Actually, you know, David, that's a very good question, and we just did a story about that last week, and about the Bombardier forecast, and Bombardier is getting more orders outside the U.S. than in the U.S. Hmm. So, over there, getting better faster, or a demand that has grown in the past few years. I mean, everybody's talking about, you know, the Middle East and Asia being, and India, being the big frontiers for business jet sales. And all of these companies are focusing on those regions of the world because there is growth in those regions. So,
all right. Anything else that we're looking for from the NBAA conference? Any surprises that you guys might be aware of?
I don't know what any surprise could be. I mean, I don't see anybody announcing a new aircraft program,
right,
that's
right.
For sure.
Yeah.
Rob?
I guess maybe the only thing I can imagine anybody trying, do you think there's a chance the Eclipse people will say that they're going to restart production on the airplane? Probably a little early for that yet, I guess, huh?
Well, actually, we have a story about that in Monday's issue, and they basically are...
Well, you guys, what are you... I mean, you guys are like a newspaper.
I know.
You're on top of everything.
I know.
We
talked with the owners of Eclipse, and they basically said they are focusing on doing the upgrades and opening service centers, and while they would eventually like to reopen production line and reopen it up back in Albuquerque, that is... much further down the road on the back burner for now.
Are any of the Eclipse jets out there that were delivered, are they being used? Are they flying?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes, they are being flown. I went up to Boston Logan back in February, and I saw the Linear Air fleet out there and did an interview with the CEO. And, you know, he's ramped back up, and they are flying.
Did they cover all the limitations that the early production models had?
They're working on those. They have two programs where you can do upgrades if you so desire. But it is going to cost you some money to do that.
Yeah, and you have to do an upgrade to do IFR, don't you? Am I remembering correctly?
Well, flight into known icing.
Ah, flight into known icing. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the airplane came from the factory with boots, but it didn't have... boots to break off the ice, but it did not have the actual certification for flight into known icing. And if you make the mods now, which they call the 1.7 upgrade, it will include that. And you know, honestly, I have to be serious. I had a chance to fly an Eclipse a couple of weeks ago, and I'll tell you, I'm betting I'm betting that that airplane's gonna come back and gonna do something, because it's a nice four place jet. I mean, it's not a, you know, you're not gonna do New York to Denver nonstop in this thing with six people in bags and all.
Right,
it's not that kind of an airplane. But as far as a relatively simple jet, some of the electronics are a little complicated, I think, but otherwise, I mean, essentially, it's a nice little jet. It doesn't burn a lot of gas. It goes high. It's going to go, you know, because the single engine jets, the Piper jet and the Cirrus jet, if they're ever built, are going to be limited below flight level 280 because they don't want to put the RVSM equipment in them, and that means they're going to burn more fuel. And I mean, I'm betting if I had had 10 bucks, I'd bet the Eclipse is someday, a couple years from now, we're going to be saying that, boy, that actually turned out to be pretty good.
Okay. Benet, anything else going on in your world that we should bring up?
How's your daughter?
My daughter is
fine.
She's
still mad at me?
No, she loves Uncle Rob now. She started kindergarten on Thursday.
Oh, how adorable.
Ooh.
Yes.
How did Mom do on the first day of kindergarten?
Oh, it was just not pretty. I had to be asked to leave.
Are you serious?
It was very sad.
That's too much.
Wait a minute, Benet, are you talking about your daughter or were you talking about Dan?
Both.
Wow.
No, my daughter. It was just, yeah. But she's in school and having a grand old time, so.
Fantastic.
Hey, Benet, can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry, Max. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but you mentioned that you came from an Air Force family. What did your dad do? I remember you telling me about this a long time ago, but I think my mind has slipped on it. If you don't mind telling us.
No, my dad was not a pilot, but he had a very interesting career. I mean, we lived in Belgium. He was at NATO headquarters, and he worked for Al Haig's staff. He was in Korea, in Seoul, South Korea, and he oversaw procurement there. His last job was at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio, and he oversaw the Air Force Institute of Technology. And AFIT was basically anybody who wants to go to school, to college, in the Air Force had to go through the institute to get permission and the funding to do it. So he's, and he, we were at Maxwell Air Force Base, so I got to see a lot of cool planes. My dad was actually deputy base commander at Edwards Air Force Base when the space shuttle still flew there. So my father, one of his jobs was to oversee the space shuttle landings when they still landed at Edwards Air Force Base.
Yeah, how cool.
So did you get to see one of those?
I did, and it was really cool. And they were also testing the B-1 bomber back then, but you weren't supposed to look at it. Of course, it's flying over our house, and I'm looking, and my father's like, you know, and he also oversaw the military police in that job, too. And he's like, you know, you're breaking the law by looking up there at that plane.
That's kind
it's of, like, thanks, Dad.
Yeah,
are you going
tough.
To arrest me?
Yeah, don't look up. Wow.
Yes.
All right. Well, Benet, people can find you, if I remember correctly, aviationweek.com/biz. Is that so?
That's
right?
Correct.
Okay, very good. Are you going to be able to stick around with us for a little longer, or do you?
I sure am.
Okay, good.
If only to listen to see Dan mess up again.
You won't have to wait long.
You
love you, Dan. Let's move on.
Yes, and Benet.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, September 10th, 2010.
Well, g'day, folks. I'm Steve, back for the Australia Desk for episode 114, and with me is Grant. How are you, mate?
Yeah, not too bad, mate. How are you going?
I'm amazed. We're actually doing this on a Friday night. Can you believe it? How organized is this?
Well, yeah, we're organized, and we've got a lot to do on the weekend coming up. I've got first aid training. I'm going flying in a yak. And we've got the dawn patrol again. So lots going on for both of us, so probably better to get it out of the way while we still have a bit of time, yeah?
No, yeah, there's nothing like a good yak, mate. We'll have a good yak now.
Oh, Yakety yak. Yep. Don't talk back.
There you go. Well, Grant, has there been any news this week around, something about Virgin Blue, Delta V, or maybe not?
Yeah, that's right. Virgin's been knocked to the curb twice in the last 24 hours. A couple of days ago, they got the word that the DOT and the USA was saying no to the Delta V alliance. Their main reasons were that Delta and Virgin had not had sufficient time working together to establish a proper relationship. And also that they didn't see that it was going to really allow all the benefits of competition that haven't already been done. So they're saying, no, go away for a little while and take some time. They're not saying it'll never happen. They're just saying they've got some objections and they don't see it being allowed for a while until time's gone on. So that was the first problem. And then today, the alliance with Air New Zealand was knocked back by our very own Australian Competition and Consumer Commission, who said, sorry, but this isn't going to help the consumer.
An interesting take on that one. I think that could swing either way. I think what their fear is at the ACCC is that, of course, they're going to create some sort of monopoly or at least a duopoly, that's going to force prices up rather than down.
Yeah, it is kind of interesting. Mate, as Ben Sandilands pointed out in his Plain Talking blog, just a little throwaway bit towards the end of his commentary on all this, was that the head of the ACCC just happens to have Chairman's Lounge access with Qantas, doesn't he?
Yeah, I just find that the ACCC, Grant, they run hot and cold on things. I mean, consumer groups are constantly hounding the ACCC to investigate, particularly the oil industry. There's always claims of collusion going on there. And, of course, the public is always quite frustrated when they come out and find that, the companies with the biggest pockets and who really run the world, like oil companies, for instance, don't ever have any competition issues, even though, the price of fuel here goes up and down all at the same time during the week. It's just amazing, isn't it? But, of course, airlines are probably easier targets and, something that's always in the public's mind and easy to go after. So I don't personally think it was a huge issue. They're not Australia's biggest airline, and Air New Zealand itself is not a huge airline, really, by world standards. And I think probably it would have benefited the travelling public here. They're still competing against other airlines such as Qantas, such as Jetstar, Qantas Jet Connect. So there's still quite a fair bit of competition going backwards and forwards across the Tasman. As we talk about quite often, Grant, it's one of the world's busiest air routes.
Yeah, well, especially if you throw on Emirates and their knock-ons, and imagine if Singapore Airlines decide to do the same as Emirates, come into Australia, keep flying on to New Zealand and back. You got these aircraft, might as well use them. What the heck, let's flood the market and drop the prices even more and see who survives. Yeah, it's going to be very interesting. And these two knockbacks, they're not over yet, because Borghetti still has the chance. He and the Virgin team have 2 weeks to come up with their responses to the objections from the DOT and the ACCC. So it's not knocked out of the court yet, but it's not looking real good either. And this does start to raise questions for the whole strategy that Borghetti's introducing of growing the airline through strategic alliances and powerful alliances with the likes of Air New Zealand, Delta V and Etihad. Because, of course, now we find that the ACCC has fast-tracked their assessment of the Virgin Blue Etihad agreement as well. So big news for Virgin, and they're taking a couple of punches, but, let's see where it goes.
Yeah, and I wonder too if this was not entirely unexpected. I mean, from the airline industry's point of view, this may well prove to be just a very interesting test case. I mean, they would have the option to take it through the courts, and in the end they might take it right up to the High Court and let them decide.
Yeah, that could be tricky in the US, but over here in Australia, I would not be surprised if they did decide to follow that path. But we'll see what happens. It's early days yet with this whole issue, and it is a bit of a surprise. Not many of us thought it was going to get knocked back. We were pretty sure that both the DOT and the ACCC would go yes to both of these, but I guess we'll see.
All right, Grant, we'll move on to our second story here, just a quick one before we finish up, and we're talking about Qantas. And Grant, how we're always saying where it's new, it's JQ, and Jetstar is basically taking over and becoming the parent company of Qantas, technically, the way we always look at it. Well, interesting, Grant. Looks like things might be just swinging back the other way just temporarily.
Yeah, it is. Things are picking up a little in the market, and Qantas have said they're starting to put some Qantas flights back onto routes that have been purely Jetstar. Now, this isn't handing it back from Jetstar to Qantas. What they're doing is they're actually increasing capacity for both Jetstar and Qantas and putting some Qantas flights on a few of the routes that Jetstar's running. A particular one that comes to mind is the flights to Hamilton Island. A very long time back when Jetstar was kicking in, Qantas turned around and pulled their mainline service off the flights to Hamilton Island because they said, it's just a tourist thing, so no one really wants to spend a lot of money. Well, it turns out there's a lot of rich people live on Hamilton Island. They got all very upset, not very happy with the Jetstar lack of quality and so on. And now that things are finally picking up, Qantas is looking at putting a few mainline aircraft on with their business class and so on. However, this now means that on some routes, you've got both Jetstar and Qantas aircraft flying on it. So there is a perception that could cause a little bit of confusion or a little bit of competition between the two arms of the same organisation.
It's interesting, Grant, in this article that we're reading here in The Australian by Damien Kitney, he's actually saying here that Qantas and Jetstar fly together on 30 routes across Australia at the moment, or actually across the domestic and international network. And it goes on to say here that the group has the flexibility to scale up domestic capacity by up to 15% this year. That's interesting, and that's a good sign, really, for the economy, if nothing else.
Yeah, well, it is a good indication that people are starting to travel again. We are getting more international passengers coming in as well. Turns out that Asian tourists are spending more than any other tourists to Australia. We're getting way more internationals coming in, and they're not just coming into Sydney, they're going to the whole country. They're being spread across the various ports that airliners can come to. So yeah, it is showing signs of picking up, but maybe this is a last gasp before yet another recession hits, or maybe things are coming back.
Well, another interesting point to look at too is that maybe this shows us, I mean, we were just talking about Qantas's main rival, Virgin Blue. Now, we talked last week and probably even the week before about Virgin Blue's shift towards chasing the business market and going for more of what would be seen as the traditional Qantas passenger. Maybe Qantas is looking at that and going, we better address this problem right now, because there has been a lot of fall off of mainline Qantas routes over the years, and a lot of those routes have been farmed off to Jetstar. And as you say, Grant, that hasn't always been popular with the travelling public. Maybe Qantas has been forced to look at this issue and say, we better address this right now or we may lose market share.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. They're now very worried about the fact that Virgin Blue is going, we've got a good share of the domestic market down at the budget end, and in the middle, yeah, it's all pretty good. But look at this big premium top end of the market, the corporate end and things like that. And as Borghetti was saying during their market review, every percentage that they grow in the corporate end translates to a percentage point of increase in their profit.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, Grant, that's interesting. And I'll tell you what, some weeks we come to the Australia desk lately and we're thinking, gee, it's been a pretty quiet news week, but we had a raft of stories. We think those are probably two of the better ones this week. But boy, it's been really interesting times with the political scene here changing in equally interesting ways. not great ways, in my opinion, but, you know, in interesting ways. And, you know, we're seeing lots of change happening in this part of the world at the moment. So, you know, I guess we're living in exciting times down here.
Well, we're certainly living in interesting times, that's for sure.
Anyway, we'll leave it there for this week, folks. Don't forget, you can also hear us on Flight Time Radio. Grant will be on this week.
Yes, that's right. This weekend, we've got another episode going out. You'll have to tune in to hear what it's about, but it's pretty cool.
Yep, and we're up to episode 42 in Playing Crazy Down Under, folks. If you haven't paid us a visit for a while, well, we'd love to welcome you back. Come and give us a listen and send us a bit of feedback. We'd love to hear from you. But that's enough shameless self-promotion for this week. Until next week, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran.
Cheers, folks.
Feedback. You talk funny.
Oh, that's such a worldly view.
But no, I see your question.
Education hadn't been lost on you, Dan. No, no doubt about it.
No, a serious question though, and I'd love to talk to Steve and Grant about this. You know, yeah, maybe on Skype sometime. Is how Qantas figures out the routes where there's Jetstar and mainline. Is it like I guess how do you decide on some of these routes that are mixed? Like where do you put the Qantas mainline? Like do you put it the mainline product that's a bit nicer on certain times of the day that appeals to the business traveler? I'd just be interested to know how they figure that out.
Yeah, that would be interesting. And now, with This Week in Aviation, here's David Vanderhoof.
Thank you, Max. Welcome to This Week in Aviation, Volume 2, Episode 29, September 12th through September 18th. September 12th, 1961. Hawker Aircraft Chief's test pilot, William Bedford, makes history by taking the Hawker P-1127 XP-831 from hover to conventional flight and then returning back to the hover. The success of this flight proved the efficiency and the stability of the Pegasus 1 engine. Hugh Merriweather, the other test pilot in the program, would reverse the process later in the day, going from conventional flight to hover and then back to conventional flight. The successes of the P-1127 would be improved with the Kestrel FG Mark 1, or XV-6A in the United States parlance, and eventually would it lead to the Harrier GR1 or AV-8A. Besides the size of the aircraft and the thrust generated by the Pegasus 11 engine, the flight characteristics of the current Harrier 2 are not much different than its great-grandfather, the P-1127. So there's one for 1950s technology. September 13, 1931. The Schneider Trophy is won for the third time in 3 years. The races were continuously held until one team won 3 times in 5 years. The Schneider races ran from 1913 and were only for seaplanes. They were held in France, Italy, Great Britain, and the United States. And the United States one was actually in Binet's hometown of Baltimore for one race. The races were set up much like the America's Cup. The winning nation got to host the next contest. In 1931, it was held at Calshot Spit and was won by the Supermarine Spitfire S6B flown by Flight Officer John Boothman of the RAF. The Schneider races were designed to develop aviation technology. Two examples of this improvement were, the first winning speed was 45 miles an hour. The winning speed of the S6B was 340 miles an hour, and 2 weeks later it became 400 miles an hour. The second example of the designs that grew out of the Schneider Cup trophies was 3 different World War II fighters, the Spitfire, the Mach-E 202, and the P-51 Mustang.
Now, September, David, was the Schneider Cup, was this a race over a marked course, or how did they conduct this?
It was a triangular course, usually over a bay or a harbor, and it was just flat out fly them like a pylon race, like they do out at Reno for the National Air Races.
Do you know? Did they compete at fly at the same time, or?
Absolutely. It was an all out. Everybody took off. They had a pace plane, and they went for it.
Oh, okay.
September 13th, 1942. A Yak-1 White 32 of the VVS, or Soviet Air Force, gets on the tail of a Junkers Yeu-88, which fell to the Yak's fire. On the second flight later that day, the same White 32 shoots down a BF-109G piloted by Lieutenant Erwin Mayer, who at that time was a triple ace. Mayer, upon his capture, demanded to see the pilot who shot him down so easily. Mayer is then marched in front of a small 21-year-old Russian girl by the name of Laya Litovyak. Maya laughed, thinking it was a joke, until White Laya, as she came to be called, recounted the complete dogfight as it happened.
Wow.
Those two kills were the first recorded in history by a woman. Litovyak would go down to shoot down another 10 or possibly 11 aircrafts before being killed, being one of only 2 female aces in history.
Wow.
September 15th, 1943, 27 Lancasters from the famous 617 Squadron, the Dambusters, take off from Yadodik in the Soviet Union. Operation Pavian had begun, its mission to sink the Kriegsmarine battlecruiser Tirpitz, harbored, spelled without a U, Steve, in a Norwegian fort. The Lancasters are equipped with the Johnny Walker 500-pound mines for shallow water. The majority of the fleet, 20 aircraft, have the 12,000-pound Tallboy bomb. On the 15th of September, they are told the weather over the fjord is clear. Upon their attack approach, the German Navy began to pump smoke in the air to protect the battlecruiser. Only the first aircraft in the attack, piloted by Group Captain James Brian Willie Tate, was able to get a glimpse of the target before the smoke closed in. Tate's bombardier, Danny Daniels, targeted the bow of the Tirpitz and scored a hit. The hole caused by the tall boy could never be repaired, so the Tirpitz was made into a floating stationary artillery piece until it was sunk. The remainder of that story is to be continued. September 15th, 2009, a humble aviation history blog was begun. Happy first birthday to what just flew by.
Wow.
My shameless self-promotion in the guise of Binet, Rob, Dan. And last but not least, September 18th, 1947, the National Security Act of 1947 creates the United States Air Force, whose current mission is to fly, fight, and win in air, space, and cyberspace. Happy 63rd birthday, USAF. And our first flights, the McDonnell Douglas F-18A Hornet on September 13th, 1978, the Airbus A330-600ST, otherwise known as the Beluga, on September 13, 1994, and one of my favorite airplanes, the Canadair CL-41 or CT-14 Tudor, September 13, 1960, and still flown today by the Canadian Snowbirds. And that's the way it was September 12th through September 18th.
Wow, your blog is a year old?
Yes, it is.
Gosh.
Congratulations.
Yeah, absolutely. That went fast.
Tell me about it.
Seems like just yesterday. Wow. All right. Thank you, David. All right. We got some interesting listener recordings, a couple of them. First, we got one from Micah. And you may recall that Micah is the son of our favorite 80-year-old listener, Harriet.
Hi, Harriet.
Here's what Micah had to say.
Hi, guys. This is Micah Engber again from Portland, Maine. And I got to tell you guys, thank you so much. My mom loves her Airplane Geek shirt, and she wears it proudly. I was calling about the recent interview with Michael O'Leary in the Bloomberg Businessweek magazine. I was wondering if you could comment on what that interview was all about and how much you think Michael O'Leary was raising bravado versus how real do you think he was in his comments. And I'm also interested in your comments and if you have anything to say about Patrick Smith's column on that interview in his Ask the Pilot column in Salon, where he goes on at great length regarding his feelings about what Michael O'Leary said, and a very well-written column by Patrick Smith, as they always are. So thanks again for the shirt for my mom. Thanks for doing a wonderful podcast, and I'll be listening in from Portland, Maine. Have a great night.
Thanks to Micah for sending that in.
This guy.
Yeah, well, you know, kind of the most amusing part of these two articles, and we'll put links in the show notes, the Business Week article and the Salon piece by Patrick Smith. The most interesting thing, I think, are the titles of the articles. The Business Week piece is called Ryanair's O'Leary, the Duke of Discomfort. Patrick Smith's article is called Michael O'Leary, Flying's Anti-Richard Branson.
I have to say, I have had the chance to hear Michael O'Leary speak live and in person.
Yeah.
And if you ever get the chance, it's something that you must do.
Is he as entertaining as it is to read about what he says?
Yes. The first time I heard him speak, I want to say it was back in 1999. It was the Raymond James Regional Airline Analyst Conference in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the luncheon keynote speaker. And you have to imagine the room is just full of guys in black and gray and navy blue suits. And he comes in, he's wearing jeans, hand-tooled leather cowboy boots, a blue and red rugby shirt, and a New York Yankees cap on his head.
Oh, too much.
And he gets up there and just completely rips apart the airline industry. The only airline he had nice things to say about was Southwest.
Hmm.
And he did it with all the profanity and all of the dirty jokes.
Really?
You either loved it or you hated it. I think about it now and I still laugh because you could see some of the people in the audience. They were just shell-shocked.
Yeah, he's quite a character. Well, in the Business Week piece, Leary asks, why does every plane have two pilots? He's thinking that given the automation, the technical level of the airplanes these days, that why do you need a second pilot? He says, let's take out the second pilot. Let the bloody computer fly it. And then when someone asked about, well, you know, what happens if that single pilot is somehow incapacitated, his idea is that, well, you train one of the flight attendants to be able to fly the plane. And when the pilot has a heart attack or becomes incapacitated, you press the flight attendant into duty to land the plane. I think the point of Patrick Smith's article in Salon is to say that, well, you know, this concept that modern airliners are highly automated and that the pilots really don't have much to do and, you know, letting the plane fly itself anyway is what's actually going on. And he's saying, I think that's, you know, really not the case. It really does require the onboard human being to operate the equipment. So, I mean, Rob, I think, I mean, you probably side with Patrick Smith on this, I would suspect.
Well, since we're both pilots, I kind of do, yeah. But yeah. I guess the way I would think about it, and of course, there's been an ongoing discussion up on LinkedIn that doesn't seem to want to die about the number of people that have comments about whether they'd fly aboard an airliner that had no pilots. But just losing one is enough. But I can only say, imagine being in the back of an Airbus departing LaGuardia when the engines quit and saying, oh, I hope that Microsoft-based computer can get us out of this one. Yeah, right. Sorry, I panned for a ticket. I want a pilot.
Give me Sully and Jeff, and I'm golden.
Yeah, I think that's the counter that you hear, you know, a lot to this argument. Some people say that, well, you know, if you compare the number of aviation accidents where the cause was pilot error, and compare that to the number of aviation near misses, like Sully's flight, where the pilot saved the flight, that there's a strong imbalance.
Probably is, but you know what? It's not simply a numbers discussion. I mean, there's way more emotion involved in this. I don't think anybody's ever going to sell people on complete automation. I know Scott Spangler and I have had this discussion many times, and he doesn't agree with me, but I just find it hard to believe that people are going to pay money to go fly on a computerized airplane.
So do we think Michael O'Leary also understands that or believes that and is just, you know, getting himself in the press again? Or do we think that O'Leary actually believes that we don't need two pilots in the plane?
Oh, I think he believes it.
Oh, I think he believes it too. Anything to save a buck, this guy will do.
Yeah.
Right, well, I mean, here's my idea. So Michael O'Leary was already saying that you wouldn't pay a fare if they install the standing seats, right? So take it a step further and have Ryanair pay you if you stand and it's on a plane that doesn't have a pilot or one pilot.
And as Mr. O'Leary would say, oh, you're well, I can't say that actually.
Yeah, you can't say that on the air.
Yeah, right.
This is a family show.
He probably couldn't agree with you.
Yeah. Well, no, but look, to be honest, I know Ryanair Michael O'Leary is known for saying crazy stuff like this, but to be honest, at least he's an airline leader who is constantly thinking.
Oh,
he's
yeah.
He's pushing the envelope.
And you got to respect that, or at least I do.
I do,
yeah.
too.
Yeah.
I honestly, as much as we pick on him, I mean, when I listen to some of the other CEOs, I had a chance to listen to Glenn Tilden at the Future of Aviation Advisory Committee in Chicago a couple of weeks ago, and wow, he certainly knows how to get people riled up, but it's not the same thing.
The triangulate and the synergy.
Well, the question is, should we make this the question of the week on our Facebook page?
Yes.
Would you fly in an airplane with only one person?
Yeah, let's make that our question.
I thought we already did that for some reason.
No, we said no people. The question is now is, would you fly with one person in the cabin instead of – our first question was no people.
Oh, you mean no pilots at all?
Right, yeah. Fully automated or remotely piloted. Sure, that sounds great. Let's do that.
You don't want to modify it perhaps and say no pilots but a couple of really hot flight attendants that could
Rob?
Run up –
The only
I was just curious. I was just curious. You know, you said you like people pilot. That are kind of testing the waters. I'm just trying to see where we're going here.
The only autopilot I want to fly with is the one from Airplane.
Well, I think the only logical step here is if, you know, we all follow Austin Powers, flight attendants will eventually be replaced with fembots.
Fembots.
So, yes.
Okay.
All right. Fembot?
Don't ask.
Am I the only one who's seen this movie? Please?
No, you're not. But
no, I just don't remember.
But we're going to move on.
All right, we got another recording. Now, you guys haven't heard this one yet. This came from our faithful listener, Peter, who's contributed a lot of things in the past. He sent some comments based on, in large part, on Dan and Court's 50-seater comments from the last episode, from episode 113. And Peter titled this From Across the Pond.
This is my message from across the pond. Hi, my name's Peter Johnson from Hampshire in the UK, and I just want to talk and give you some feedback about the recent Bits and Pieces episodes of the Airplane Geeks, where Dan and Courtney talked about the people who are complaining about 50-seater regional jets and some of the smaller aircraft that are now being traded in for larger jets. Now, don't get me wrong, I fully understand the arguments and understand why the airlines are undertaking this this process. But I just want to say I love flying and I love everything about aviation. And there isn't a flight that I get on that I don't get very excited about and learn everything about and enjoy from start to finish, whether it's a 30 or 40 minute internal flight within the UK or whether it's a 10-11 hour transcontinental flight across the pond to the States. Now, I describe myself as a little bit of an airline snob, if I'm absolutely honest, and I think most people do. I think most people have a slightly distorted picture of what aviation is these days and what service it provides for us. I think many people look back on the golden ages of aviation where service was first class with a small F and a small C, and everything was provided on those flights, whether it was a short flight where you were given free drinks or whether it was a long flight and you looked forward to your meal. I've loved aviation for as long as I can remember, and the first flight I took was when I was 12 on a British Airways 707 out of Heathrow, transatlantic. I mean, we had flying fish served on that menu. That's how exotic things were a little while ago. And I love everything about flying, and luckily my career allowed me to get on three or four flights a week. And also to vacation on lots of special aeroplanes, 747s of all types, Airbuses, A340s, MD-11s, L-1011 TriStars, Hawker Sydney 748s, you know, lots of aeroplanes that probably Dan has never heard of. Well, unless he reads his history books, that is. So let's get back to the critiques of the smaller jets and people not enjoying that experience. I fly regularly on Q400s, only about an hour. The flights and the tickets are cheap, and the service is really functional. But that's what I understand that service to be. You know, you get what you pay for. So let's look at everyone's punch bag, Ryanair. I don't care for them. I don't care for their service. I don't care for their chief executive or the way they publicise themselves. But they're cheap. And functional. And I've had to fly them. I had to fly them on business once to Nîmes in France because they were the only airline who flew there. They were cheap, but the service was shocking. My colleague who sat next to me had a sandwich that came out of the trolley and it was frozen so hard you could break a window with it. You've got airlines like EasyJet. You know, a few years ago I flew from London Luton to Liverpool for £25. That's about, I don't know, $35. I flew that route because it was cheaper than the petrol to put in my car. The flight took an hour. It took 4 hours to drive. You know, you get what you pay for. And I think nowadays people like to complain because it's easy to complain because they feel they deserve a better standard of service than they're getting. Well, you know what? You pay for it, you get it. So let's come back to Courtney's point about people complaining about the smaller 50-seat jets, the smaller turboprops, and how they have an expectation of bigger aircraft, wider aisles, better seats, and so forth. The airlines that bought these jets, these turboprops, originally were there for a reason. They were there to give us cheap tickets to places that we wouldn't normally be able to get to at that sort of low-cost price. And I come back to this expectation that the service needs to be of a higher standard, and people like to complain about Ryanair and EasyJet and Tiger. If you don't like them, don't pay the money, don't go. Pay more and go elsewhere. you know, what do people really, really expect? For a £25 ticket, what do you expect? Quite rightly, you don't expect to be standing up. But if you pay £25 for a flight, or in some instances 99 pence or £1.99 for these ridiculous tickets that low-cost airlines put out, you have to expect that the service is not going to be the same. And coming full circle, you're going to have to expect that the aircraft these airlines fly will not be the same and will not provide the service I talked about earlier. You're not going to get flying fish on the menu. It's just not going to happen. You get what you pay for. So I'd like to come back to this expectation about the complaints about some of the smaller aircraft, the smaller 50-seat jets, the small turboprops. They're not big enough, they're not comfortable enough, they don't have enough overhead baggage room. We want more, we want more, we want more. Well, you know what? You've got to pay for it. The reason these airlines had these aircraft is because we weren't prepared to pay the premium price to have a better quality aircraft. So, my message from across the pond this week is, you get what you pay for, and if we're not prepared to pay higher fares for a better class service, for a better type of aircraft, you know, our expectations will be that we will, in 10 years' time, be standing on a Ryanair aircraft across Europe for a 2 or 3 hour flight, or across America, or, dare I say it, for the boys down under, on a Tiger Airways flight, dying to go to the toilet because we've run out of change. So that's Peter Johnson signing off from across the pond for the Airplane Geeks.
Oh, Peter did a nice job on that, huh?
Well, yeah. I mean, except for the fact that I didn't buy some of what he said. I mean, I think that, you know, there's a certain element of what he says that's true when maybe when you're talking about Ryanair, but at least here in the States, you fly on some of the regional airlines, and boy, it is not cheap. I mean, they have some of the most expensive segments in the country, and I mean, they would be expensive anyway, even if they are operating mainline airplanes. But I think that's why they are expensive, because the airlines can do it on a regional jet and charge you a hell of a lot of money for some of those segments. So paying more doesn't necessarily ensure that you're going to get a better ride.
I have a great example of that. When I used to work at Rolls-Royce, you know, I worked in the Chantilly office outside of D.C., we had the Rolls-Royce plant in Indianapolis. There was a Dulles to Indy flight on Chautauqua, which was U.S. Airways Express, and there was also a United Express flight. One was on an Embraer, one was on a CRJ. That ticket price averaged $845.
Wow.
Now, you could go to drive up to BWI, and it went down to like 300. But you have to remember that most of the Rolls-Royce people lived out in Chantilly and past there. So driving to BWI was a long haul. Then Independence Air came along, and the price plummeted. I mean, you could go sometimes well under $200. One time I even got a fare for $100 round trip. And so all the fares dropped. And as soon as Independence Air went away, so the fares went right back up.
Well, the only thing I'd add is that in some cases, it's the low-cost carrier operating the mainline aircraft that might have better overhead bin space and other features. And then the other thing is about RJs is, 50-seaters aside, I think on the larger RJs, it's becoming better. And I mean, United has had their X-Plus product for a while, so with first class, and right now both Delta and American are rolling out first class on their larger regional aircraft. So,
I did have a chance to go up to Chicago when American Eagle rolled out their first class product, and I took some pictures and did a meal tasting with the chef. And that is a really nice product, I have to say.
Okay. Well, we'd like to thank Peter for sending in that recording. I think that took some effort for him to put together, but But we really appreciate that.
Yeah, even though we didn't agree with you, Peter, it wasn't personal. I mean, we liked the effort. We just didn't happen to agree.
Well, I agreed with his statement, you get what you pay for.
Yeah, I do, too.
Yes, yes, that too. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So babies, we've established that Rob Mark is, in addition to the Betty White of the podcast, also now the Simon Cowell of the podcast. Oh,
God. That just, okay.
I told you not to let him back on.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, I think that's it. Any shout outs? I have one shout out. I just want to mention there's the European Private Aviation Conference that's coming up in Vienna, Austria. That's November 1st and 2nd. There's a link to that on the blog on airplanegeeks.com if you're interested in learning more about that conference.
I have a shout out.
Go ahead, Binet.
Oh, sorry. I have a shout out. I did a guest column in Cranky Flyer's BNet website. We're talking about the Registered Traveler Program, which is my topic of interest these days. So I'd love it.
Ooh, I like that one.
And, you know, I'd love to hear your thoughts about it.
Terrific.
And actually, I really enjoyed that post. So because I approve it, I mean, now you know that you will enjoy it too.
It's got the Dan Webb stamp of approval.
Stamp of approval.
Okay, great. Anybody else?
If anyone's going to Naval Air Station Oceana's air show this weekend, Friday and Saturday, let me know because I will be down there covering for the Airplane Geeks. I got a bunch of interviews already lined up, so I'd love to meet anybody. So if we want to have a tweet up out on the beach on Saturday night when they do the night jump out onto the beach with the British jump team, so give me a tweet and I hope to meet everybody. If you see a guy running around with a microphone, it's me.
Very good. All right. Okay, we'd really like to thank our guest, Binet Wilson from Aviation Week. Binet, tell everybody where they can find
Max,
you.
Does she really qualify as a guest anymore?
Well, it's more...
I mean, she's on the podcast every week.
Not every week, but quite often.
Yes,
she is.
Yes, I am on the podcast every week.
Oh, yes.
That's right. How do you reach the Airplane Geeks?
Hey, yeah, maybe it's time to get a new Binet. How do we get the Airplane Geeks on the phone?
No.
We want to stay with that old
It's a classic. Horrible idea.
We like the old...
It's the only estrogen this show has when I'm not on here. So come on. Leave me alone.
No, I meant maybe it was time to get you to record it again.
Oh, okay.
Just as a new version of it, I meant. Well, maybe we'll try that. I wasn't talking about getting rid of you.
Oh, okay. Just keep digging deeper.
Just a refresh, Binet. Where do people find you online?
You can find me at aviationweek.com/biz. I'm also doing some writing for the commercial side of the house now. I've got the security beat back, so you can see my stuff on the Things with Wings blog, which is aviationweek.com/wings.
Cool. And how about on Twitter?
On Twitter, you can find me at avweekbinet and avweektweets.
Very good. Thanks again for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
And we also want to thank Steve Vischer and Grant McCarron for their Plane Crazy Down Under Australia Desk report. So, Rob Mark, tell people where they can find you online.
Well, they can find me at jetwine.com, and they can find me on Twitter at jetwine. And when I'm not there, I'm here waiting to discuss our relationship issues with Dan.
Okay. And Dan Webb, how about you?
Find me online at thingsintheSky.com. You can also find me on Twitter at Dan Webbage.
Terrific. And David Vanderhoof, how can people find you online?
You can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof or my blog at whatjustflewby.com.
Great. And I'm Max Flight. You can find me at 30,000feet.com or on Twitter at Max Flight. Be sure to see airplanegeeks.com for show notes and listener comments. You can follow us on Twitter at Airplane Geeks or send us email at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. Also, be sure to visit our fan page on Facebook. That's facebook.com/airplanegeeks. And perhaps the best way to get a message to us is to leave us a voicemail on our listener line. Binet, do you remember the number?
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS-01.
That's it for episode 114. And join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Night, everybody. Thanks for listening.
See you later. Good night.
Good night, Harriet. You didn't go down low as you went.
I mean, keeping everybody in under one holding carrier, but yeah, keeping the brands.
So, Dan, have you moved into the echo chamber now?
You know where Dan is? Dan's in the men's room.
He's in the bathroom.
He's been relegated to the stairwell.
Leaning against the urinal.
Well, no, because the issue is, one of my roommates is playing the piano, another won't shut up. So yes, the background noise has posed an issue.
Dan, you should do what I did with my daughter. Just take them upstairs and lock them in a closet. No problem. Solved.
Oh, Rob, did you hear that?
I'll let her out.
Binet locks her child in a closet.
Okay, hold on a second.
I was working on a blog entry for tomorrow. Let me see if I can figure out a way to work that into the story.
Hey, I let her have her iPod.
It sounds like Dan fell down the stairs.
I know, you're all right, aren't you, dude?
Dan!
To all our listeners out there, we are really sorry.
I am going to change location, and I will be back with you momentarily.
Okay. Meantime, let's look at what USA Today had to say. It's getting worse.
He's going to get drunk in someone's car.
All right. Well, while Dan seeks shelter.
I'm waiting for this little voice.
Help me. I'm falling. Help me. Help.
Okay. Oh, my gosh.
No, I have life for that, actually.
Okay. You sound much better now.
Yes. Well, now I'm outside, and I'm going to walk to somewhere. I don't know, because I need iPhone power. So, just walking around. Keep going. Keep going. Don't let me bother you. and
Max, I just don't envy you.
Just hang up on him now.
Jesus. David, are you close enough to be able to throw something at him?
And just so you know, guys, this is what this episode has gotten me to. Pop. Okay, beer number one.
Beer number one.
Pass me one, please.
Just read some of this first.
Really?
Yeah, I just thought I'd be a rebel.
You're setting a bad trend for the scene, man.
Yeah, I know.
You're going to let the community down, mate. All these podcasters who've never read an article that they talk about. I mean, really.
Well, you know, in the words of a podcast I was listening to recently, I'm just a GA pilot. What would I know?
Put that in the bloopers idea.
Oh, did I record that? Oh, sorry.
Actually, what you want to do is just have in the bloopers me going, put that in the bloopers, I dare you. That'd be good, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Did you guys see, you can see Steve's son, Chris, on YouTube playing the drums. I don't know if you guys saw that.
I mean, he was making just as much noise on that little two-minute thing as Dan was through the rest of this podcast. So,
yeah, well, good point.
What difference?
Very good point.
But Chris was more melodious, though.
True.
Is this just the dump on Dan hour?
Yes, it is. Welcome.
Welcome to Dump on Dan.
I'm your co-host, Binet Wilson.